This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up in today's programme, as relations between Turkey and the EU plummet to new lows, what lasting damage might the escalating war of words have on the economies and military alliance NATO resulting from the row? The UK Prime Minister Theresa May faced a rowdy Prime Minister's questions in Parliament today, the first since a contentious spring budget, the passing of the Brexit Bill and the renewed threat of a Scottish independence referendum. We'll be bringing you all the highlights. Social media companies could face multi-million euro fines if they fail to remove hate speech content. That is the threat facing Facebook, Twitter and other social media networks under new plans announced by Germany. But given the global nature of such networks, can these companies realistically be expected to act effectively against a growing tide of online hate? Amid the harrowing reports of widespread human rights abuses in Myanmar's Rakhine State, the UN Special Rapporteur has called for a high-level investigation. But why is the international community so reluctant to back such an inquiry? And apparently, 79% of people admit to having eaten food that's fallen on the floor. But what if science could prove that it's actually safe to do? All of that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. An escalating war of words between Turkey and Germany is straining Turkish-EU relations to breaking point after the Turkish president accused the German government of backing terrorists. But what lasting damage might the row have on Turkey's military alliances with many EU member states and the Turkish economy? Mark Hurst has this report.
Germany is mercilessly supporting terrorism. That's the conclusion of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan as he launched yet another fierce attack on yet another NATO ally. The comments signal a further deterioration in relations between Turkey and EU and NATO member states. At the weekend, the Turkish president branded the Netherlands Nazi remnants and fascists after the Dutch government refused to allow Turkish ministers from speaking at political rallies in Rotterdam. This in turn prompted German Chancellor Angela Merkel to come to the Netherlands' aid, obliquely describing Erdogan as a Turkish personality and suggesting his comments were misguided.
I rejected the rhetorical and other Nazi comparisons in regards to Germany by Turkish personalities in the German parliament.
Angela Merkel there. So with Turkish and European relations at an all-time low, how damaging has the row been to what were once close political and military allies? Well, earlier I spoke with Dr. Bahar Basar, Research Fellow at the Centre for Peace, Trust and Social Relations at Coventry University. Dr. Basar, are you surprised at the apparent ferocity and deeply undiplomatic language that has been directed towards Germany by Turkish President Erdogan?
I'm not surprised at all, because I have been working on the Kurdish diaspora for the last 10 years, and our president, and not just him, but other politicians since the 90s, have used the same rhetoric against Germany on a number of occasions. Because of the Kurdish diaspora and their activities in Germany. So now the political scene has changed in Turkey and now there are new enemies, but the discourse stays the same.
And Germany is understandably sensitive to associations with the Nazis. And despite a long-standing, mostly friendly rivalry between the Dutch and the Germans over the years, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has come to the Netherlands' aid on this issue. How would you characterise growing EU perceptions of Turkey at the moment?
I would say in the beginning, when AKP came to power almost a decade ago, EU had really positive relations with the governing party, and they saw it as a kind of a political party that would reform Turkey and make Turkey get closer to the EU membership. But obviously this is not the case right now. And I'm not surprised, but I'm just noticing more and more that European politicians are not shying away from using words like dictatorship or authoritarian regime while defining Turkey. And this shows that the perception is changing drastically.
And how concerned will other EU countries be about what appears to be an increasing authoritarian Erdogan, and does it have any consequences for Turkey's future membership of NATO?
There have been some discussions about this starting from the last 2-3 months of 2016, whether Turkey is getting closer to Russia and leaving its Western allies. I think in the long run, that's not a feasible strategy for Turkey, and I don't think Turkey will be leaving NATO membership anytime soon. I think this is just about domestic politics diffusing to the international arena at the moment. And the political party is using this kind of rhetoric for a reason, because we have a referendum in a month. So they have to use these populist discourses to gather nationalist votes. But in the long run, I think NATO membership is really, really important for Turkey, especially if you consider what's happening in the Middle East. It needs stronger allies, and no other institutional organizations offer this kind of security to Turkey rather than NATO.
And President Erdogan has accused Germany of supporting terrorism. How much do you think that might feed into fears among some in German society about the large number of refugees and immigrants the country has accepted in the wake of the Syrian crisis?
I mean, I would say Turkey's domestic disputes diffused to Germany many times before, and this only harmed the Turkish citizens who are currently living in Germany, and the second generation and the third generation, because this is increasing the negative image about immigrants in general. And of course, Erdogan is using this terrorist discourse for many groups, including the Gulenists and the Kurds. And this is also creating an image in Germany as if the Turkish conflict is being recreated in Germany, and there are many conflicts among different groups. So I think in the long run, this will only affect the Turkish population living in Germany negatively.
And is there any evidence suggesting that the row is harming Turkey economically? Because after the dispute previously with Russia, it did seem to have a fairly significant economic impact on Turkey.
Yes, I'm sure it's going to affect even more. But so far, they managed to control the crisis one way or another. But I think in the long run, hard days are in front of Turkey, yes.
And once the Dutch election and Turkish referendum are out of the way, what steps do you think the two countries might take to normalise their relations? And are there any international players who might help facilitate that?
I was thinking, if you asked me this question this morning, I would say yes, diplomatic relations will heal after the elections. But today, our president just made another declaration accusing the Darfur, the Srebrenica genocide. So I think the level of discussions are getting lower and lower, despite the fact that Dutch politicians refuse to engage in such discussions. But we should obviously consider that both countries have elections, and they have to use a populist discourse to gather nationalist elections. So if they keep on prolonging this conflict, the winners of this these discussions will be the extreme right wing in the Netherlands and the AKP and President Erdogan in Turkey. And I'm sure after the elections, things will calm down, because I don't think Turkey can afford having this kind of bad relations with its neighbours and Europe for a long time.
Dr. Basar, it's a developing story and a very interesting one, which I'm sure we'll come back to. But in the meantime, many thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus.
I thank you very much.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May faced a rowdy Prime Minister's questions in Parliament today, the first since the contentious spring budget, the passing of the Brexit Bill and the renewed threat of a Scottish independence referendum. We'll be bringing you all the highlights in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik Britain's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
When and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May faced a rowdy Prime Minister's questions in Parliament today. It's the first since a contentious spring budget, the passing of the Brexit Bill and the renewed threat of a Scottish independence referendum. We'll be bringing you all the highlights. Social media companies could face multi-million euro fines if they fail to remove hate speech content. That is the threat facing Facebook, Twitter and other social media networks under new plans announced by Germany. But given the global nature of such networks, can these companies realistically be expected to act effectively against a growing tide of online hate? And apparently 79% of people admit to having eaten food that's fallen on the floor. But what if science could prove that's actually safe to do? You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 13 minutes past the hour. Now, it's only been a week, but a lot has happened since the UK Prime Minister last faced questions in Parliament. There was last week's spring budget statement. Then there was the Brexit Bill, which allows the government to officially begin the process of leaving the European Union, being passed. And on top of all of that, the Scottish Government has signalled its intention to seek permission to hold a second referendum on independence. So, to get you up to speed with what's happened this afternoon, here's Jack Foster.
Today's Prime Minister's Questions, that's the weekly chance members of the UK Parliament get to put questions directly to Theresa May, was always likely to centre on the issue of Brexit and the threat from Scotland on Monday of a second independence referendum. As far as all that was concerned, there weren't many surprises, except if you were looking for clarification on the major bones of contention in British politics right now, those being when Article 50 will be triggered and whether the Scottish Government will be granted the right to hold another independence referendum.
them, well, you could very well have felt a little short-changed. The early stages of today's PMQs focused on the more internal budgeting in the UK following the government's U-turn on a tax hike announced last week, which had also been a U-turn from the governing Conservative Party's own manifesto, which they took into the last election. But it was the Westminster leader of the Scottish National Party, that's the pro-independence governing party in Scotland, Angus Robertson, who was first to raise the thorny issue of Brexit.
Only days remain until the Prime Minister is going to invoke Article 50 on leaving the European Union. And last July, she promised to secure a UK-wide approach, an agreement between the devolved administrations of Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the UK government before triggering Article 50. So when will the Prime Minister announce the details of the agreement?
Prime Minister!
I said to the Right Honourable Gentleman yesterday and to others asking me questions on the timetable yesterday, we will trigger Article 50 by the end of March. There will be an opportunity for further discussions with the devolved administrations over that period. But when the Right Honourable Gentleman looks at the issue of membership of the European Union and his view of Scotland not being a member of the United Kingdom, I say this to him. He is comparing membership of an organisation that we've been a member of for 40 years with our country. We have been one country for over 300 years. We have fought together, we've worked together, we've achieved together. And constitutional game-playing must not be allowed to break the deep bonds of our shared history and our future together.
Prime Minister can wag her finger as much as she likes. Last year she made a promise. She promised an agreement. I asked her about it yesterday. She didn't answer. I asked her about it now. She hasn't answered. When will she reach an agreement, not discussions, an agreement with the Scottish Government before promised an agreement? There's not an agreement. When will there be an agreement? Because does she not understand that if she does not secure an agreement before triggering Article 50, if she is not prepared to negotiate on behalf of the Scottish Government and secure membership of the single European market, people in Scotland will have a referendum and we will.
We have been in discussions with the Scottish Government and with the other devolved administrations about the interests that they have as we prepare, as the United Kingdom Government, to negotiate a deal on behalf of the whole of the United Kingdom. A deal which will be a good deal, not just for England, Wales and Northern Ireland, but for the people of Scotland as well. And as we go forward in negotiating that deal, I think the Right Honourable Gentleman should remember this. Scotland will be leaving the European Union. It will leave the European Union either as a member of the United Kingdom, or were it independent, it's very clear with the Barroso document that it would not be a member of the European Union. What we need now is to unite, to come together as a country and to ensure that we can get the best deal for the whole of the United Kingdom.
The UK Prime Minister Theresa May in a somewhat rowdy exchange with the SNP leader Angus Robertson there. And yes, the UK Parliament is made up of fully grown adults, hard though that might be to credit listening to that audio there. The noise in the chamber was a little bit more polite though during the opposition Labour Party's Stephen Doty's question to the Prime Minister, where he critiqued both the Conservative government's exit from the European Union and the SNP's, whom he disdainfully referred to as they, desire to withdraw from the United Kingdom.
It is our two single markets that are the backbone of our economy, and yet the Prime Minister wants to rip us away from one and they want to break up the other. Can she tell me, is it really a price worth paying, the risky and reckless approach she is taking to Brexit to foster the breakup of Britain?
Prime Minister!
The Honourable Gentleman is wrong when he uses the term that I want to rip the United Kingdom away from the single market. What we want to do... I'm sorry to say to honourable members on the Labour benches, this is the same answer that I have given consistently in this House. We want to ensure that we get a good free trade agreement which gives us the maximum possible access to the single market to enable us to trade with the single market and operate within the single market.
Theresa May responding to a question from Labour's Stephen Doty at today's Prime Minister's questions. But, of course, notably absent from her response was any reference to the Scottish question. No worries, though, it did come up again more than a few times. The Scottish National Party's Mike Weir referred her back to her exchange with Angus Robertson.
An answer to my honourable friend from Moray, the Prime Minister called for respect. But that's a two-way street. Where is the respect from your government for the Scottish Government's compromise proposal, which has just been ignored in these negotiations?
Prime Minister!
The compromise proposal has not been ignored. It has been discussed by ministers with ministers from the Scottish Government. There are many areas within that proposal on which we agree, as I've said before, such as on ensuring our security from crime and terrorism and maintaining and protecting workers' rights.
Another question from the SNP benches came from Callum McCaig, who somewhat mischievously framed the issue of Brexit in terms of an argument that would be familiar to many in Scotland during the 2014 referendum on independence, where opponents had argued that Scotland couldn't have afforded to become an independent country.
The UK has one of the worst performing currencies in the world. It has a trade deficit of £133 billion and a national debt approaching £1.7 trillion. Can I ask the Prime Minister, does she really believe that the UK can afford to be an independent country?
If he wants to talk about figures around in relation to the UK economy, the UK economy is the world's sixth largest economy. This government has reduced the deficit by two-thirds. And if he cares to look at the employment figures we see today, employment at a record high and unemployment which hasn't been lower since 1975.
The UK Prime Minister Theresa May responding to the SNP's Callum McCaig there. Interestingly, though, still no real acknowledgement of the elephant in the room, that being the threat of a renewed referendum on Scottish independence, as announced by the Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon this week. The Scottish National Party's Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh had another go.
Our First Minister was elected with the largest votes in Scottish parliamentary history on a manifesto pledge which stated that the Scottish Parliament should have the right to hold an independent referendum if there's a significant and material change in circumstances, like Scotland being taken out of the EU against our will. So my question to the Prime Minister is simple. Does she agree that governments should stick to their manifesto promises? And if so, she cannot object to the First Minister sticking to hers.
I, of course, recognise that there was a vote that took place for the Scottish Parliament and the First Minister was returned as the First Minister of a minority government. But I would refer the Honourable Lady to two other votes that took place. In September 2014, the Scottish people were given the opportunity to vote as whether or not they wished to remain in the United Kingdom. They chose that Scotland should remain part of the United Kingdom. That was described by the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Gordon, as a once-in-a-generation vote. And the other vote to take note of is that on June the 23rd last year, the people of the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, and that is what we are going to do.
And that was the closest that Theresa May got today to even hinting at what direction her government would lean in the event that the Scottish Government requests a Section 30 order next week to hold a second referendum on Scottish independence. Frustrated, though the Scottish benches might have seemed during those exchanges, in many ways they could take some comfort from the extent to which the Prime Minister was couching her words. Given her previous rhetoric and opposition to Scottish independence, one might well have expected her to write off completely the prospect of granting the Scottish Government any such power. But she didn't. On the other hand, It's entirely possible that she's simply biding her time until the moment of truth, when Nicola Sturgeon puts in that formal request, something which is expected to happen next week. Either way, Theresa May now faces a political juggling act that few in her position have had to endure before her. Not only must she argue the case for Britain's future as an independent country, but she must simultaneously argue the complete opposite for Scotland. She may be keeping her cards close to her chest, but she may just as easily have no idea what to do. And if that's the case, well, even her staunchest critics would probably have some sympathy for her position. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
Yes, a very rowdy Prime Minister's questions today, and Jack Foster joins me in the studio to discuss this further.
Very sympathetic to Theresa May, Jack Foster.
As we heard there, Theresa May was a bit cagey about giving any sort of definitive statement on the issue of Scotland and the second referendum. Should we be reading much into that?
Well, this is a current affairs programme, Carolyn, so we should read as much as we possibly can into it, at least for the next few minutes whilst we're talking about it. There is plenty you can read into it, but it's very difficult to really know what's going on, and that's all because of the timescales of the major events that are involved in this, which are, of course, the triggering of Article 50, which will start the Brexit process, and all this talk now of a Section 30 order for the Scottish Parliament to hold another referendum on independence in Scotland. Neither of those things have happened yet, so they're kind of hanging over everything, and all the announcements are holding off. We heard the answer that Theresa May gave to Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh during the Prime Minister's questions there of the Scottish National Party was kind of the closest she came to responding to that question. But of course, she didn't really say anything that she hasn't said before, that the 2014 independence referendum in Scotland was a once in a lifetime, once in a generation, etc. The Scottish people have already spoken, that we're about to enter into Brexit. We're entering into Brexit as one united kingdom, one country, and so on. Nothing really new there. But what she didn't say, which is what I think a lot of people might have expected, was that she might have made a stronger statement with regards to the Scottish situation, and probably saying something on the lines of there will be no second independence referendum. What we can gather is that Number 10 Downing Street are waiting to see the wording of next week's motion, which will come out of Holyrood, which will be the official request from Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, for a Section 30 order which will allow them to hold a second referendum. Once they know what that is, there will probably be a stronger statement that will come from the UK government. But there has also been comments coming from the Scottish Secretary in the UK government, David Mundell. He said in an interview with the Herald newspaper in Scotland that effectively nothing could be decided or discussed really until after Brexit. He was saying that without the knowledge of what the package would be that the UK government would take to Brussels, it's impossible for an informed decision to be made. And he also said that people would need to know what the quote SNP alternative to that proposal is. You must remember that the UK government frames the entire movement for Scottish independence as being one political party, which it isn't.
Mm-hmm. And all in all, though, this is quite the political headache for the UK government in the moment.
Yes, it presents very much of a political headache, because what does Theresa May do? She has to go ahead with Brexit. She has to take the UK out of the European Union, according to the referendum last year. She has very much staked her whole prime ministership on that, and she's underway with that, and that she's supposed to be triggering Article 50 by the end of this month. The one thing that she doesn't need happening alongside that is an independence referendum in Scotland. As I said in the report there, it puts her in a very strange position, and in fact it puts the UK government in a very strange position if there were to be an independence referendum in Scotland taking place simultaneously to Brexit negotiations. Because how can you, on the one hand, say the best possible thing, the most democratic thing, most wonderful thing for the United Kingdom would be to be independent, to take back control of everything, to become an independent country free from this big union, and simultaneously saying, but of course, Scotland wanting to be independent and free from this big union is a bad thing. It's not an easy argument to make. I'm sure she'll have a go.
Well, Jack Foster, thank you.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
The This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 29 minutes past the hour. Facebook, Twitter and a host of other online social media networks could face fines totalling tens of millions of euros under legislative plans announced by Germany on Tuesday. The German Justice Ministry appears to have lost patience with social media companies who have failed to act quickly to remove racist and xenophobic posts by their users. But given the global nature of such networks, what realistic steps can they take to tackle what is a growing problem? Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
Germany has increased pressure on Facebook, Twitter and other social media websites to do more to remove hate speech or face the prospect of major fines. The German Justice Minister, Heiko Maas, yesterday announced voluntary methods used by the companies in recent months had failed to crack down on illegal posts containing racist or xenophobic views. Germany's Justice Ministry will now progress plans to introduce new laws that could lead to fines of up to 50 million euros being imposed on social media companies if they fail to remove hate speech posts within 24 hours. So why have social media networks so far failed to act against such content? And what technical challenges do companies and the authorities face in trying to rid social media of already illegal online material? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Fiona Martin, a senior lecturer in convergent and online media at the University of Sydney in Australia. Dr. Martin, how big a challenge is it for social media networks like Facebook to police what would be deemed by any reasonable person as online hate speech?
It's an enormous challenge. Social media companies don't think of themselves as media or publishers in the traditional sense. They call themselves IT companies. And they come from the US free speech context. So I think in some senses they just weren't prepared for the enormity of being expected by countries around the world to police the speech of their 1.23 billion users. That's daily of December last year. So, you know, even where they can use software to automatically isolate banned words or contentious keywords in people's posts, those posts still need human reviews. You know, I don't think anyone would particularly want their posts taken down by intelligent machines. So, you know, Facebook's got quite an auditing or moderation problem that they never expected. They argue that by the end of the year they're going to have 700 people alone just working on the German content review process. So imagine that they need even half that many people for responding to legal publishing problems in each country internationally. It is a big problem.
And Heiko Maas, the German Justice Minister, has said that this new proposed law that they are planning to introduce follows months where social media companies have been allowed to deploy voluntary measures to address this issue. Do you think the companies have missed an opportunity here to act effectively against racist and xenophobic posts?
A few problems in the way that the actual review was set up, for a start. I don't think it was entirely transparent exactly what they're supposed to act on. And interestingly, if you look at research that's been done into how experts understand what hate speech is, even academic experts disagree on what might be racist or xenophobic in different contexts. Because a lot of it is contextual. What is racist to me may not be racist to you, and also the degree of hate that we experience, you know, in different circumstances will be different for different people. So I think, you know, they had a really difficult task. That said, I don't think they probably did put enough effort into it. I mean, it's hard to say because, look, the really big problem is we don't know exactly what effort was put into it. When we're talking about private companies here, they are not public. They're not like the BBC or the CBC or any government companies that might have a little bit of transparency about the way they go about these processes, these review processes. This was quite, you know, from the European side, you know what the reporting methods were, but from the social media side, there is far less clarity about how the reviews went through.
And I suppose with different international interpretations of what constitutes hate speech, how much do we know about the rise in hate speech postings on social media, and are we seeing it occur globally? I mean, it'd be difficult to measure if there's not an international definition of what hate speech actually constitutes.
Absolutely. So that's one of the problems. The other is that even though there are lots of small projects going on, at the moment, there isn't an international effort to define this. I mean, there are some very good project looking at hate speech comparatively across countries, but I don't think we've got a global project on this yet. And yeah, we do know that there is a rise in hate speech globally. We can you can see it in instances like the refugee crisis in Europe. You can see it around very different circumstances in different countries. In Australia, there has been, for example, a debate around our discriminatory speech laws, and they wanted, you know, a number of parties wanted our laws to be softened. Now, you can start to see hate speech actually on the rise around the debates about that. I think the other thing is that as people see other people getting away with it, they push the envelope further. So the more that we see, you know, kind of quite extreme speech being enabled or being allowed on these platforms, the more that people will think that they have license to do that.
And are there potential freedom of speech issues here if it's left purely to the social media companies to police and determine what is and what is not hate speech?
Well, freedom of speech is one of those really problematic issues because, again, depends on which country you're in as to what you think is freedom of speech. The social media companies are all the product of the American free speech regime, much more open and much more libertarian than, you know, what you'd experience in Britain or Scotland or Australia or anywhere that you have much tighter controls on what you can publish, defamation laws, for example. So, yeah, I think it is difficult to leave it purely to the social media companies, partly because also they do not accept responsibility necessarily for it. I mean, they are media companies. They make their revenues out of advertising, but they do not wish to be known as publishers in the old sense. All our traditional laws around what can be said in the media are based around print and broadcast. They aren't really shaped for the age of international digital communications, and I think that's where we've got a problem.
And the German government are determined to take some action here, but how difficult a challenge is it for the governments to act when the internet is a global network and users can use virtual networks or other techniques to bypass domestic laws? It makes it very difficult for governments to act effectively, surely.
Well, it's impossible for them to act in all jurisdictions. I mean, it's like, you know, King Canute and the waves, really. And let's face it, we are grown-ups as well. When we go to, for example, a network like 4chan, forums like 4chan, that's really, I mean, there's a lot of trolling goes on there, and indeed that thing, people there think it's fun. It's actually a game. It's part of the joy of being part of that community. However, I might find what's said there or in various parts of Reddit really offensive. Now, the question is whether it's up to me to remove myself from that circumstance or whether I want to engage with those people and tell them what I think of their offensive speech. In some senses, what is being said in forums across the world really is not able to be controlled. However, when you've got very broadly used tools like Facebook and like Twitter, and where these are seen as by their users as media, I think that's when we need to work out ways in which users can work with the social media companies to have effective governance regimes. And when I say governance regimes, I'm talking about not even necessarily having laws, but having agreements between users and social media companies about when they will take stuff down. And at the moment, the social media companies are not responding to users.
Does this apparent rise in hate speech, what does it tell us about the human psyche? Have those kind of views always been there, or is it just simply that the internet has allowed people to facilitate and articulate those views in a more public way?
I think the latter, certainly. Of course, there's always been hate and hate speech. There's a beautiful book, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, by Whitney Phillips, which looks at the fact that a lot of the debate around incivility online really forgets that there has always been incivility in public places. It's just the velocity and the volume and the visibility of it now that troubles us. And to some extent, I think also the difficulty with social media is that we think when we're setting up a social media network with our friends that we all will agree on how to talk together. But we don't. You fight with your friends. Sometimes you say things that you regret. So, of course, we're going to see speech that is incivil, angry, sometimes abusive. The problem is that it's there. It's published. We are now publishers, just like we were, we are journalists to some extent when other people read our comments and share them with half a dozen other people. That's something that I don't think ordinary people were prepared for either. You know, our children haven't been taught the basic rules of journalism, and schools are kind of scared of social media too. So in a lot of instances, I don't know how it is in Scotland, but in Australia, most primary schools, for example, don't use social media in the classroom, and so kids don't get taught what the basics of, you know, publishing are.
And in terms of dealing with this, would it make any difference if there was international cooperation that brought together companies and governments to establish some internationally recognised standards here?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. And look, it's already happening. This conflict that we're seeing in the EU, and particularly with Germany in the lead, is really a fight to get the social media companies to recognise that there needs to be some sort of governance and that they need to respond more effectively to their users. And I mean, in some respects, you know, people could say, oh, it's the nanny state and governments don't need to intervene. But if someone says something that is criminal about me, or they constantly abusing and harassing me, and I try and contact Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, and they don't respond, how vulnerable does that make me? And what does it say to me about my value to that social network?
It's a very interesting, fascinating subject. Dr. Fiona Martin, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Mark.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, amid the harrowing reports of widespread human rights abuses in Myanmar's Rakhine State, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Myanmar has called for a high-level investigation. But why is the international community so reluctant to back such an inquiry? We'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together, you ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, amid the harrowing reports of widespread human rights abuses in Myanmar's Rakhine State, the UN's special rapporteur on human rights has called for a high-level investigation. But why is the international community so reluctant to back such an inquiry? And apparently, 79% of people admit to having eaten food that's fallen on the floor. But what if science could prove that that's actually safe to do? You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 43 minutes past the hour. For several months now, there have been harrowing reports of widespread human rights abuses carried out against the Muslim minority Rohingya population of Myanmar's Rakhine State. This week, the UN's Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Myanmar, Yang Hee Lee, has said that the evidence she has gathered, quote, indicates the government may be trying to expel the Rohingya population from the country altogether, end quote. Ms. Lee called for the establishment of a commission of inquiry, the highest level probe the UN can carry out, but noted a distinct lack of support within the international community for such an inquiry. Yang Hee Lee said members of the international community, quote, won't say they're not going to support your call, but I do hear countries say that maybe Aung San Suu Kyi needs more time, end quote. That is in reference to the leader of the nation's civil government, Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Laureate who many had hoped would act to end the persecution of the Rohingya population. Earlier this month, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mr. Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein, also called for an international investigation at the 34th session of the Human Rights Council.
Mr. President, last month I issued a very disturbing report on the alarming scale and severity of operations by the Myanmar security forces against the Rohingya men, women and children in Rakhine State. These operations began in October after a reported attack by armed assailants on three border guard facilities. Myanmar denied access to my office, and so our report stemmed from a mission by my office to Bangladesh, where some 73,000 Rohingya refugees have fled. It found material evidence and corroborated eyewitness accounts of mass killings, including of babies, children, and elderly people unable to flee, and the burning of entire villages, shooting, massive detention, systematic rape and sexual violence, and deliberate destruction of food and sources of food. It appears that what has been termed by the security forces a counterinsurgency operation is in reality aimed at expelling the Rohingya population from Myanmar altogether, as the special rapporteur has said. The severity of the reported violations against a backdrop of severe and long-standing persecution appears to me to amount to possible commission of crimes of against humanity, which warrants the attention of the International Criminal Court. I therefore urge the Council, at minimum, to establish a commission of inquiry into the violence against the Rohingya, particularly during security operations since the 9th of October 2016. I reiterate our standing request to open an OHCHR office in the country.
That was the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mr. Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein, speaking last week at the 34th session of the UN Human Rights Council. Several human rights organisations have documented the abuses faced by the Rohingya population. Amnesty International highlighted the most recent rise in abuse in their 2016-17 report on Myanmar. It states that following attacks in October last year on border police outposts in the north of Rakhine State by suspected Rohingya militants, quote, security forces responded with a major security operation conducting clearance operations and sealing the area, effectively barring humanitarian organisations, media and independent human rights monitors from entering. Security forces were responsible for unlawful killings, random firing on civilians, rape and arbitrary arrests. The response collectively punished the entire Rohingya community in northern Rakhine State, and the conduct of the security forces may have amounted to crimes against humanity, end quote. Human Rights Watch have also detailed harrowing accounts of widespread rape, extrajudicial killings, torture and arson, allegedly at the hands of security forces. Earlier, I spoke to Phil Robertson, the Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division, and I began by asking him if he agreed with the statement made by Yang Hee Lee that support across the European Union and the wider international community for an inquiry was tepid.
I think it is a bit tepid, although we and others have been working very hard to change that, and I think we're making progress. I think we are getting towards what we want, which is an independent international investigation of what has happened in Rakhine State since October 2009, you know, looking at all the rights violations that have happened there and trying to identify perpetrators. But it's been a real slog. It's been very difficult. And I mean, the European Union, frankly, is still trying to get the Burmese government to agree to a consensus resolution. And we're concerned that if that happens, what we would see is a watering down of the resolution because, you know, the Burmese government doesn't want anything to do with this. They want to try to persuade the international community to let them handle it, to let their completely flawed and totally uncredible national investigation continue, and that would be it. And people are just not going to accept that.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like the level of allegations is just incredibly severe. Some of the accounts are incredibly harrowing, and it does strike me that if we heard those kind of accounts from many other nations, there would be an international response, there would be sanctions, there would be consequences. Do you think that this is, you know, what's the reasoning behind giving them more time and giving them more freedom to act here?
Well, at its most basic, I think the number of the nation states in the European Union are concerned about causing any sort of problem for Aung San Suu Kyi. They are trying to say that if we raise issues related to the Rohingya, if we raise issues related to what the security forces have done in Rakhine State, that this will cause a problem for her. And we have said, well, look, Aung San Suu Kyi has not been with the troops on the ground, and she has not been burning down houses or raping women or, you know, extrajudicially killing men. She's done none of that. This has been the security forces. This has been the military. Let the focus go to where the focus should be, which is the behavior of the Burma army, which is a army that has continually abused human rights whenever it operates in areas where civilians are present. So, you know, why are you trying to defend Aung San Suu Kyi from something she didn't do? You know, but again, there's a great deal of nervousness within the diplomatic corps in Yangon. There's a great deal of concern amongst the capitals that they do nothing to undermine Aung San Suu Kyi. And we think they're missing the point that if something like this happened, as you mentioned, in many other countries around the world, the move towards a commission of inquiry would just be automatic.
Mm. With, you know, social media and the internet, we live in an incredibly connected world, and we're much more aware of what's happening around the globe than we previously were. But it does seem that that tends to result in a more reactionary approach when it comes to public opinion rather than preemptive. You know, if we look at the refugee crisis, for example, the public outrage didn't happen until we saw pictures of children on a beach dead, and there were harrowing images that created a public outcry. Do you think that we are in danger of acting more in a reactionary manner rather than preempting now? Is it gone beyond that?
Well, I think what we're looking at now is a situation where over 75,000 Rohingya have fled out of these areas where the campaign by the military has taken place into Bangladesh. And so more and more people are going to interview those Rohingya. And many of those accounts that you're finding in UN reports and reports that we've brought out and others have brought out are from those refugees explaining what they faced before they finally fled. And I think that what people are taking away from that is that there's a very serious human rights atrocities to answer for. It quite well could constitute crimes against humanity. And, you know, this has happened before in Rakhine State to the Rohingya. This happened in 2012 when we and others documented ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity against Rohingya, not just in the northern part of the state, but across Rakhine State. And at that time, nothing was done. So it's important that this time that, you know, the international community ensures that there is a real investigation and that, you know, names are named and that people are held accountable.
Surely what many say would be a destabilizing effect of an international inquiry is overshadowed by the level of the reports that you're getting from those that have fled.
I think that's very much true. I mean, we are looking at cases of, you know, systematic and widespread use of sexual violence and rape, instances of men and boys being killed. You know, there are instances of children being killed in front of their mothers. We documented with satellite imagery the destruction of over 1,500 homes in the clearance area that the military designated. And this area still is largely blocked off from international humanitarian assistance. So there's a significant shortage of food, as well as other basic services like, you know, medical services, not to mention schools or anything else that would, you know, constitute a normal part of life that people would expect to see in these areas.
How hopeful are you right now? How hopeful are you that things are moving in the right direction, that there might be an inquiry and that this might get addressed?
We think it's moving in the right direction, but we're certainly not out of the woods yet. The European Union is pretty divided on this. We haven't seen a paramount champion step up. In the past, it was Britain, but this time around, Britain seems to be playing for the middle rather than deciding to take the leadership role. And that's really quite shameful. We think that Britain should be leading the way again, as they did in previous instances when there was efforts to call Burma out on human rights abuses. Their voice resonates in that country, and they should step up and lead this.
Well, Phil, thank you very much. It's a pleasure having you back on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
And finally, we've all been there. You've just toasted your last bit of bread. You've found just enough jam at the bottom of the jar. Yes, a lovely late night snack awaits, and you're just seconds away from tucking in. But just as you pick the plate up from the counter, all your hopes and dreams are shattered as the toast careers in slow motion towards the floor. And, of course, it lands jam side down. Well, it might not be as bad as it sounds, according to Professor Anthony Hilton, who's going to be demonstrating exactly this at the Big Bang Fair in Birmingham, which opens today. He's a germ expert, and according to his research, provided you pick it off the floor within 5 seconds, it's still okay. The sorts of harmful bacteria that could be picked up are unlikely to do so in under 5 seconds. This comes as a survey revealed that 79% of people say they've eaten food that's fallen on the floor. Oh, and it's probably worth clarifying, the 5 second rule doesn't apply if your floor is dirty. That's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a few moments we'll be handing over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. I am Carolyn Scott, and I'll be with you tomorrow. Until then, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
After decades of Western regime change in the Middle East, a line has been drawn in Syria, though at enormous human cost. On the 6th anniversary of the start of this conflict, I sit down with Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos to survey the wreckage of Western foreign policy and look at the reality of Trump's presidency and his stance towards Syria and the conflict after 4 months in office. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.